Thank you for downloading this episode of My Perfect Console. If you're enjoying the podcast, please consider becoming a Patreon supporter. You'll get your episodes early and ad-free, learn about upcoming guests, and receive bonus content. Your support also helps fund episodes just like this one. Head to patreon.com/myperfectconsole.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to My Perfect Console. I'm Simon Parkin, and in each episode I invite a guest to pick the five video games they would like to immortalise on their very own fictional games machine. Perhaps it was the first game they received as a birthday present, or the one that so obsessed them it caused them to fail their exams, or maybe it was the only thing that got them through a difficult breakup. Games, a bit like songs, often become powerfully attached to a particular moment in our lives. When we return to them, they can become warp points to the past. So join me, Simon Parkin, for My Perfect Console. My guest today is an English stand-up comedian. Born in Nottingham in 1993, they studied drama at De Montfort University, where they became an active member of the university's comedy club. After graduating, my guest then worked for the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Art while performing on the circuit. Their first show, Dark Horse, was nominated for Best Newcomer at the 2018 Edinburgh Comedy Awards and included on the second season of Soho Theatre Live on Amazon Prime. They soon became a fixture on television and radio, appearing on Mock the Week, 8 out of 10 Cats, Richard Osman's House of Games, and in 2021, Live at the Apollo. Now my guest is returning to the stage with a new tour titled My Eyes Are Up Here, described by The Guardian as engaging and touching. Welcome, Sarah Keyworth.
Thank you. Well, that's, hearing it all like that, it sounds good, doesn't it?
It is good.
It sounds amazing. I might keep. Have you got a copy that I can have for like an obituary or something?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I'll send it over.
The way you had it written down was lovely. We'll save that. That's great.
So let's talk about your new show, Sarah. It's centred on your relationship with your mother, who, like many teenagers, you clashed with during those years, and how, I guess, more recently you've recontextualised some of that period of your life as someone in their early 30s, accepting that you were raised with love and all that kind of thing. What prompted this reassessment? Was it just getting a bit older?
Well, I think the big thing that prompted it was that I had something called top surgery last year in September. And the kind of crux of the show is that I had this incredibly sort of protective upbringing. My parents, very, ridiculously strict, but, you know, we were raised in quite a firm way. It was quite a firm hand, and anything that was considered dangerous or harmful was avoided. And I think I thought that when I told my mum that I wanted to have this quite major surgery, she would tell me that she didn't want me to do it. She'd say no. And I still have that sort of relationship with my mum where I'm worried about her telling me, no, you're not allowed to do that.
Right, yeah.
And I completely misread the situation, really, and that my mother's priorities are just that I'm happy and that I feel good in myself and that I'm well. And I suppose looking back, you think actually that's all that she was trying to do that whole time was just to keep me happy, keep me well. So yeah, that's why I started to look at it in this different perspective, I suppose.
Yeah. It's like a real theme in culture at the moment, I think, thinking about the ways in which our parents might have failed us.
And yeah.
For those of us who like have children, how we might be failing them as well.
Yeah. And I kind of wanted to do a reverse of that where it's I think I say in the show, it's very easy to go on about the things that your parents got wrong. But I think the hardest part is realizing the things they got right and having to kind of accept that maybe you were wrong. Maybe you didn't know everything. And maybe they did have your best interests at heart at some stages.
In education, they talk a lot these days about good enough parenting. So, you know, that's just the bar that people should be aiming for. What do you personally think are the, you know, really important things to get right?
Well, I think the sort of biggest message of my show is having the best interests and just loving sort of, you know, without fail. You know, you could be angry, you can be furious, but the love has to still be there, I suppose. And I think every parent is going to fail at some point. They're going to make the wrong decision just because, you know, we don't know everything about the world. We don't know everything about how things are going to change in 20, 30 years' time. So you just got to try and do your best. And yeah, be understanding. The overall feeling that when I look back at my upbringing, of course there were things that my parents did that I look back and go, you just didn't understand what I needed, and you couldn't get your head around where I was at that point. But I can't say at any point that they weren't trying to do what they thought was the best thing.
So I was looking back at your own journey in terms of the shows that you've done. And I think it's probably fair to say that you've used comedy as a way to almost chronicle your own journey as a queer person.
And
as you've sort of gone on that journey, right, you've taken audiences with you. In your new show, you describe yourself as an emotionally unstable non-binary with pronouns of there.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is an outstanding joke.
Thank you.
But I wondered, like, has it been, you know, helpful or challenging sort of exposing those questions that you've had yourself, you know, on a public stage? How's that been, you know, making that all open to everyone to see?
I think incredibly helpful. I mean, all I wanted to do when I started doing stand-up was be funny, but I think I realised quite quickly that I was going to have to sort of get on stage and explain myself a little bit as the way I present and what my lifestyle is. There's a sort of big thing of people going like, why can queer people only talk about being queer, or, you know, why can people of colour only talk about being a person of colour and stuff? Like, there's this sort of criticism of comedians talking about their identities. And I think the answer to that is that it's still a question that people have about me. You know, if you walk on stage, people go, well, we want to know what's going on with you. The most common comment I think I get on social media is that a man or a woman? So until that stops happening, I suppose I do have to kind of keep addressing the immediate questions that people have when they see me or they hear me talking, or they as much as I'd like to be a really sort of neutral blank slate, that's my dream. I'd love it if nobody had any kind of preconceptions or thoughts or questions about me when they saw me, and they're just interested in what I had to say or my perspective of the world. That's not the reality that we live in, I think. So yeah, I think it's been very helpful. And what I love about doing it is that the people who've had similar experiences to me, or whose children have similar experiences to me, which is a new one that's happening now, where people get in touch and say, my child is non-binary or my child is queer, or I'm having these conversations about gender with my 5-year-old, 10-year-old, 15-year-old. It's been amazing to feel as though I'm helping, I'm supporting people, and I'm not just screaming into a void, which I do a lot of as well.
I think we are moving, hopefully, towards a place where it's not something that you have to put front and centre all the time. I've had quite a few non-binary people on this show, and I actually haven't ever asked any of them about it before, because I kind of, like exactly what you were saying there, I kind of think, well, you know, it'd just be nice to talk to people as people rather than having to get into that stuff straight away. But I suppose, you know, I was interested in your case, because it is something you talk about on stage quite regularly about. Yeah, I wonder as well, you know, that vulnerability, you're so vulnerable with your own journey on stage, and you use material from your therapy sessions in your work as well. And I suppose the risk for anyone who earns their living from being confessional, and this like goes for people who write columns or whatever, it's not just stand-ups, but there's a risk that you don't keep any space in your life private.
Yes.
How do you ensure that there are like rooms of Sarah Keyworth that are not for public consumption?
I think it's a really, it's an interesting question. I actually had this because the show I did before this one was, it did feature stuff about going to therapy, because I was sort of working through things like grief and stuff like that. And I came back from the Edinburgh Fringe after having performed it for a month and went into a therapy session. And my therapist said to me, actually, I wanted to talk to you about the fact that she had been with a friend who was also a therapist, and her son had come back from the Edinburgh Fringe and said to the two of them, oh, I saw this show, you guys will be interested in this, because the comedian talked a lot about therapy, and told them about it. And my therapist was sat there going, you've actually got no idea how interested in this I am, because
oh my gosh,
I am that therapist. And I mean, it was an awkward situation. I felt quite embarrassed about it. Yeah, sort of, I was on Zoom and I could see my face going red. But then she's such a wonderful therapist. I kind of explained that the caricature of a therapist in that show is a sort of amalgamation of experiences that I had with a therapist. So it wasn't specifically her.
Nice Dave.
Yeah, she said, I don't mind, actually. I wanted to talk to you about how it makes you feel that this has come back to me, how this is supposed to be a pocket of peace and tranquility. And actually, your public life has found its way into this relationship that we have. And I thought that was an interesting and very thoughtful way of tackling that situation.
Yeah. How did you feel?
I felt kind of mortified, to be honest. and I appreciated her handling of it as well. But I think I do draw the line at what I do share. And I tend to try and check with people whether they're okay with the things I'm sharing. My girlfriend has quite hard lines on what is allowed to be said on stage and what is not allowed to be said on
stage. Right, yeah.
And also quite hard lines about when and where I'm allowed to think and talk about my career. So we have a cut-off point at various sort of evenings and weekends where I'll be sat looking at something on my computer and she'll go, no, you're done now. You got to get your head out of there. So I'm very lucky that I have good friends and good family and a partner who have absolutely no interest in the comedy industry.
Excellent. That sounds very healthy.
Completely disinterested in my career in any way. Just want me to shut up and hang out with them, which is nice.
Right, so let's turn to the premise of the podcast. So I've asked you to pick the 5 video games that you'd like to put on your very own perfect fictional games machine.
I think these were panic picks, by the way. I think it was about half an hour ago that I chose them, so I don't know if I stand by them yet, but we're going in, we're doing
we'll get into it. Yeah, okay, all right. I mean, what role have games played for you in your life? It's sounds like you've always enjoyed games. Have they been a place of refuge or something else for you?
So when I've always been, I'd say majoritively a PS player, PlayStation player.
Yeah.
I've got an older brother. We had a PlayStation 1 when we were kids and I loved play. So I think my early memories of like gaming were with my brother and also with my cousins.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very close to cousins that are similar age to me. One of my best friends is my cousin Jack, and also very close with his brother Josh, but he's a little bit older. So we all went to the same school. We used to live next door to each other when we were kids. It was a very, very close relationship, and we'd go on holiday together, and my cousins would bring their PlayStation with them, and we'd go to like Norfolk, and we'd set up on the TV in this little house that we were staying in.
Oh, nice.
And we'd get up at like, I don't know what time, 6 o'clock in the morning, whilst our parents were all lying in. We'd come downstairs and you'd grab yourself a box of the like variety pack cereals.
Yes.
And we'd eat them dry out of the packet, and we'd pass the controller around and playing things like Tekken. It was a very communal thing, and it was a very sort of satisfying thing. So I didn't really get into kind of, I mean, I've never been an online gamer. I don't do the sort of multiplayer online, but I love playing with other people in the room. And I didn't really get into sort of solo gaming until I was more of a teenager, and we had a PlayStation 2, I think, at that stage.
Well, I mean, it seems like a good time to come to your first pick, which is a multiplayer game all crammed around the TV. Yeah, tell us about your first one. What's the game then?
So this is one of the games, this is why I didn't mention it. This is one of the games that we would sit around and play in Norfolk. I don't know who bought it, I don't know where it came from, but I think it was the PlayStation, I think it was the original Worms. The best thing about this multiplayer game for children who just love the sort of silliness and destruction and all of the creative little weapons that you can come by and the competitiveness of it. It was just, it's so much fun. And I suppose the most accessible thing about it is that it's all played with one controller, and you just pass that controller around.
Right.
And you take it in turns.
Yeah, so each player has, is it four worms that they control, sort of little worm soldiers who can...
Yeah.
And you pick what moves to do, and you're trying to take out the other teams of worms, aren't you?
It's such a simple game. You get placed onto a sort of ridiculous landscape. You have your color team, red, blue, green, or whatever. I think you can name your team, and the weapons that, so you're trying to sort of maneuver yourself across this landscape and get to other people's worms, and they are just these tiny little worms, and you move at the slowest pace, so you can, and I think you have 90 seconds to take your go or something like that. So you could spend 90 seconds just getting from like one point to another point. And there'd be, you know, the offensive manoeuvres that you could take range from literally prodding somebody off a mountain to, you could choose a poke function where you just nudge them off.
Yes.
To, you maybe end up like getting sort of like Armageddon features where it just rains and it's just like, you're just, there's a possibility of just destroying everybody on the board. So my brother's tactic was always, he'd spend his goes sort of tunnelling into the earth. So that he was hidden from any sort of major, and there was like, I think there was something like a donkey. I've got a PlayStation 4 now, and I have a Worms game, but nobody wants to play with me.
Yeah, they had an exploding sheep as well, didn't they? I remember
exploding sheep, which was impossible to control, and homing missiles, things like that. Yeah, an Uzi.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. There was just, it was just so, so good.
Yeah, like you say, you could name your worms as well, which gave it this real sort of like weird intimacy.
Yeah.
Or like you'd feel very protective over them. Do you remember what you'd name your worms after?
I think I would call my worms after my cousin and my brothers, because I like the idea of them having to murder themselves in worm form. And we'd be sat there going, no, not Jack. Don't kill Jack. But it was just, I just remember finding it all just sort of hysterically funny.
Yeah.
The whole thing. And we'd just laugh for hours playing this stupid game. And I think it's, yeah, there's very few games that are perfect for four people. And that one was just so engaging and ridiculous and very nostalgic.
Yeah, what a lovely memory. That's brilliant. Right, so let's come to your story. So, yeah, tell us about growing up in Nottingham. What was that like?
I mean, as I say, I have a very lovely family and a very nice upbringing. We grew up in various different locations in Nottingham, but when I finished primary school that we moved to this place next door to where my cousins lived, in quite a rural area, which was lovely. So it was quite quiet, quite a peaceful existence. I mean, in terms of sort of video games, it's making me realise that I think I spent most of my time sort of hauled up inside on a computer or something like that. My brother, I never got into it, but my brother really was into things like World of Warcraft and stuff like that. Again, it never appealed to me because I didn't really like these sort of online gaming functions. And so I've just got memories of sort of being in our house on like a really hot day. My brother had a laptop, so he had World of Warcraft in his bedroom with the curtains closed so that there was no glare on the screen. And then I would be downstairs on the family computer and my mum sort of coming through and switching it all off and going, you got to get outside, dragging us out. And these horrible tempers of these preteens who are being forced to go out and stand in the sun. When all they want to do is feed their addictions.
Yeah, yeah. A tale as old as time, or at least as old as the 1980s, I guess.
Yeah, I can still sort of vividly recall the pungent smell of my brother's bedroom. And my mum just clear, and they're like, the dust coming off the curtains as she yanked them open and opened the window and tried to just air us all out. It was, I think, a pretty good upbringing.
You talk about in your new show having undiagnosed ADD. How did that manifest when you were a kid?
I think I was forgetful. I was very disorganized. But then, I mean, yeah, probably an element of obsession and hyper focus on things that gave me immediate dopamine. But yeah, the way that it manifested itself, I only found out I had ADD in 2022, end of 2022. And so it was just complete, daydreaming all of the time. And I would forget things. I would leave things in different places. It was lucky that we lived next door to my aunt and uncle because my mum gave me a key to our house and I would lose it pretty much every week. And so I would just, my mum would come back from work and I'd be over at my aunt and uncle's house waiting for her to come every single day.
So you'd get back to the PC.
Yeah, yeah. She'd come into my aunt and uncle's house and I would be sat behind my cousin as he plays World of Warcraft watching him play.
And Nottingham was, for a few years, there was Nottingham Game City, which was a fantastic video game themed conference that happened in the city. Was that sort of after your time?
Yeah.
Or did you ever go along to that?
That is not something that my mum would have ever taken us to, I don't think.
Oh, that's a shame.
Yeah, I mean, I think we would have loved it. There was a couple of times where there was a big Warhammer world.
Oh, yeah.
Were you ever into Warhammer?
I wasn't.
I don't know whether it was big or whether it was just in my memories it was big. There was a huge, it felt like a big warehouse and it was a big shop. My brother was very into Warhammer and I was not as into it. But again, like the concentration that it required to paint all of these individuals.
Right.
I'd like get one, completely destroy it with paint and then get angry and leave it. But we spent a lot of our time in that big Warhammer world in Nottinghamshire. And it was like a big, they had tournaments there. So there was huge landscape tables for them to battle on. But I think I would have been happier at the games console.
And you go on to study drama. Was that like always the hope that you'd become an actor when you were a kid?
No, not really. I was in an amateur theatre group when I was a kid and a teenager. And it was definitely sort of a source of, it was outside of school. And it was a sort of refuge in the sense that, I mean, some of my best friends now I met in that drama group. And
oh, amazing.
It was kind of just a sort of, yeah, tale as old as time, basically. And it was all these little awkward theatery misfits, which is not always, but sometimes does translate to the other queer people who don't know they're queer yet. And I loved going. And it was the only thing that I was really that enthusiastic or interested in. And of course I wanted to be an actor, of course, but I definitely did not have the skill set. But I tell this story every single time anyone asks me about my university experience, because it pretty much sums up in terms of my relationship with my mom. I was really unhappy when I was doing my A-levels. I think I was just having, you know, teenager kind of misery. So it's a shit time to be kind
difficult
of trying
time,
to work
yeah,
out
yeah.
what you're going to be doing for the rest of your life when your hormones are rampant and your
right.
social life can be a bit influential. And think, I think I'd just been dumped by somebody and I was feeling really miserable. And I didn't want anything to change. I felt quite comfortable at school and like went in sick form with all my friends, and I didn't want to do it. And it was the year before all the fees went up that was mine.
Oh, right. Yeah.
The one shot. And my mum basically went, if you don't go now, I don't know how we're going to be able to do it. And sort of just, so she took me to De Montfort and left. We went to a few open days and things like that. And she liked the look of that one. And she went, I think that would be a great choice for you. And I went, fine, whatever.
If it'll make you happy.
Fine. Because it was, yeah, she was saying to me, like, if you don't go this year, the fees are going to, you know, it was they were going from $3,000 to $9,000 a year. And I
right.
think she just was like, you've got to get out of this fucking house. And just sort of, yeah, booted me out the door. And little did she know, and little did I know, that the Leicester has a very, very active comedy festival. And there was a very active comedy society, and it was people doing stand-up at my uni. It wasn't sort of sketch comedy or, you know, kind of footlightsy type groups.
Sure.
It was individuals doing stand-up. It doesn't exist now. People don't, like, it didn't happen. But I just happened to be there at the same time as a group of fucking nerds who wanted to be stand-up comedians. And it just really, really fortuitous, basically, that I ended up there at that time.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, we'll come back to that part of your story, Sarah, but for now, let's turn to your second game choice. Yeah, tell us about this one. Yeah, what's the game?
It's The Sims. I'm glad we're doing this in chronological order, because I do think that this is actually going in the order of my life and when I played these games. Though if I sometimes it crosses my mind to get The Sims on my laptop now, and then I think no, because I will never get anything done ever again. and that's the same logic as to why I'll never buy a portable console. I'll never buy a Nintendo Switch or anything like that, because the only thing that keeps me from playing on my PlayStation all the time is that it's fixed in one location. The Sims, those hot days as a teenager in the kitchen at my parents' house playing on the family computer. I was completely obsessed. I think I would be obsessed with it now. There's something so satisfying and addictive about The Sims. It's such a good game.
What was the, how did you play it? Because some people kind of develop stories for their characters and all of that kind of thing. And
yeah.
What was your sort of preferred way to enjoy the game?
I wonder, looking back now, whether there was an element of gender expression in the way that I played it, in that I would often start by creating a man. I would make a man and it'd be called something like it's actually, if we made a list of like the top 10 most popular names that trans men choose when they're changing their name, I imagine that my Sims had some of those names. We're going for like Jay or like Psy, stuff like that. Like
right, yeah.
Like bro names, basically. Brad was a big one. And what I love to do, I would be very into, because it was like these, you'd choose like an aspiration path for your Sim. So it would either be that they were like sort of like a family sim, family orientated, or they were career, got like focused or something like that. And I was very into choosing whatever that was and then really going for it. So I loved going for the career one I liked making my sim an astronaut and then very much focusing on getting their skill level up so that they were getting promotions and making a lot of money. Which you think about that and you think, if you spent that much effort just focusing on your career, what could you? The hours that I made my sim work out at the gym, like, imagine what my body could look like if I'd given it that time. But then one of the things I love to do, which is, I don't know, probably something for my therapist, if I was feeling sort of mischievous, was I'd get my sim to be like in love with multiple other Sims.
Okay.
As many as I could before I got bored. And then I would invite them all over at the same time.
Oh my God. Chaos ensued.
Just to see the fight. Just to watch the chaos. Yeah.
Yeah, what's that about?
What is that about? Why does I want that?
Gosh.
And then my Sim would be miserable because all of his girlfriends had broken up with him at the same time.
Right, they'd all storm out.
Yeah, exactly. They all slap him around the face.
Cool. Okay. Yeah. I don't think we've got enough time to get into that, but
I know there's so much we could say.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
All right, let's come back to your story then, Sarah. So, yeah, you mentioned being at De Montfort and getting into trying out your stand-up. Do you remember your first gig? How did that go?
My first ever gig was at school. It was in sixth form, and it was a charity event, and I think I did some of the most embarrassing sort of puns, and it went amazingly well, but that's because half the audience were like my mum and her friends. And then I started gigging at uni. And I mean, I was so shit. I think I was awful, but I was very enthusiastic. I used to do deadpan. That's what I did for a while.
Okay.
I mean, I am a little bit deadpan in the way I perform now, but like it varies. Whereas I was completely, I think it was a slight defense mechanism of like, if I'm completely straight faced in a sort of character, then you're not really, if it doesn't go well, they're not really rejecting me. They're sort of...
Right, yeah.
So, yeah, I used to, my early gigs, I did complete straight face, vegetable puns, no laughing.
You got an example? Sorry. You got your head in your hands.
I'm trying to remember how it began. It was like for God's sake. I can't remember how it began. It was like food puns. Oh my God, it's so, it's awful actually thinking about it. I know one of them was not necessarily. And it was like, we're taking you into custody. And then I think the final one was the proof is in the pudding. Oh God, it's awful. Absolutely awful. That says maybe not necessarily was my pride and joy.
Right, yeah. That's nice. That would do well on Twitter in a word game type hashtag thing.
Oh, but I used to stand on a stage and say it in front of people.
Well, let's turn to it.
It was a story, but they just, the puns just kept coming.
Right. Oh God! Oh, for the God. Listeners, the reason I'm laughing is Sarah has their head in their hands.
And crumbled. Completely crumbled.
I'm sorry. Let's turn to like happier times then. Yeah. How did you transition to doing, you know, more personal material? A bit, you know, like we were talking about at the start, were you a bit more vulnerable?
Oh, that's a good question. I think it's when I wrote my first hour. I had an interesting experience because I'd sort of started going to watch people doing longer shows, and I think it was at a time when the hour-long show in Edinburgh was becoming a bit more professional, and it was kind of an introduction of you to the industry, and
right.
there's an appeal right now to sort of identities and stories and what makes you sort of stand out, I suppose. And I knew obviously kind of my relationship with gender and my experience growing up, and then I was working as a nanny. That was what happened. I was working as a nanny to these two children, a boy and a girl, and the boy is maybe 2 or 3 years older than his sister. And she, I mean, I'm still in touch with them now. I see them all the time, but she was the most confident little person I'd ever met in my life. She's so strong, so opinionated. She was 5 when I met her. She's so opinionated and very vocal and not fazed by anything at all. And I was, as I say, still in touch with them now, so that she's 12 now. But I sort of watched the years that I worked with them and stayed with them as this confidence started to sort of wane, and there were sort of doubts setting in, and these stereotypical language that comes for every child, I think, of, you know, that's not for me, I'm a girl, I can't do that, or I'm a boy, that's not, you know, that's a girl's thing, I can't do it. And watching it, kind of just seeing it live, seeping into their brains. So that was what my first hour was about, was this kind of my experience with it growing up, having been there and felt it happening, and then watching it happening to these children, and kind of, just sort of speculating on how what could be done, or how anybody could do anything about it, I think. But I think it's easier when you're writing a long show, you're writing a full hour of comedy. I think sometimes it's just easier to anchor it to a story. Or like some kind of prompt. So I think I try to do that sometimes with my shows, where like I'll go, okay, so the theme of my show with this one is kind of acceptance. And a lot of the shows, the stories in my new show, you might think they're going one way and it's going to be a story about bigotry or something like that, or feeling rejected. But actually it's consistently positive and about people surprising you. So yeah, I think that's probably why I started to get a bit more personal, a bit more professional. And also probably because there's only so many vegetable puns. You can't do that for an hour, can you?
You can't do celery for an hour, no.
Can't do celery for an hour. I would try. I'd certainly go for it.
All right, Sarah, let's come to your third game then. So this one is a little bit more recent, from 2008. Tell us about this.
Oh my God, I've forgotten what it is.
The one with Sackboy.
Ah, yes. Yeah, I love this game so much. Again, this is the multiplayer element. I have played this game on my own.
Wait, Sarah, you have to say the name of the game, just so I can do the thing.
I have to say the name of the game. The game is Little Big Planet 3.
Thank you.
Little Big Planet 3 is the game I've played. Is that the 2008 one, or is
I think 2008 was the first one, but never mind. We'll just,
Little Big Planet 3 is the one I've played. There is a Sackboy game as well, I think, because the one after that was Sackboy. But I love this game. My girlfriend and I have played this game together. So we've been together about, it's like 3 years now, 3.5 years. And she was never interested in gaming, had never picked up a PlayStation controller in her life, and wanted to have a go. And I said, let's play this game, because I think it's very sort of user-friendly. And I find it so funny. I think it's such a fun... The game is, you're a little sack creature, and the voices in it as well, in terms of a cast, it's Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie, I think, are the voices in Little Big Planet 3. It's amazing. I think there's maybe some other people as well. And in Sackboy, the one after that, Dawn French, isn't it?
Really? I didn't know that. Cool.
It's a credible cast of British talent. And it's just so... You can personalise your character, so you can collect little items, outfits for them to wear along the game. And it's just so... The creativity of all of these levels, the illustrations, the animation is so, like, wacky, that it's just so fun. And then the satisfaction of spinning and twirling and jumping, and you get all these gadgets, and you can, it's just so enjoyable. But there's also, it's just like the way in which you fail on this game is so funny. So we're playing it, and I'd just be laughing hysterically. There's just something really funny about it. I can't really explain it. It just makes me laugh.
It's kind of, for anyone who's not, I'm sure everyone knows it, but it's sort of like Sony's version of Super Mario, but it's got this real like craft aesthetic, like Sackboy is made out of wool and, you know, it's all like sticker tape and cardboard and things like that. And like you say, I suppose that gives it this quite playful feel, like, you know, being flung around.
It's quite dark, like the illustration is, it's very, you know, colourful. It's the Imagisphere is the world that it's set in, but like there's dark elements, like there's levels with sort of fish heads pop up and creepy illustrations it's quite a hard game actually as well. The gameplay is quite challenging. So it keeps you your mind in it, and you have to kind of work. The only thing about it I can say is that it just makes me laugh.
There's a big part of Little Big Planet is the user-generated levels, so people can create their own levels and upload them. Have you ever been tempted to make your own stuff in it?
No, stuff like that. This is the thing, we're talking about The Sims. My brother used to, this is the sort of difference between our brains. My brother was the kind of Sims player who would spend hours and hours building a house.
Yeah.
Whereas I was like, no, I just want to get in there with the story. I want the people and the characters. That's my interest. So no, it just doesn't appeal to me, the building of it. I think I'd get too frustrated. I'd get frustrated if it wasn't going the way I wanted it to go, or didn't work the way I wanted it to. Yeah, just that element just doesn't tap into the thing that satisfies me. Whereas I just like to have a character spin around on a loop over and over again, and then fall into a pit of spikes.
Yes, there's quite a lot of violence towards your characters in your choices here, Sarah. Yeah.
So much. I don't know what's wrong with me.
So yeah, I wanted to ask you, the show that you did before the current one that you're on, it's titled Lost Boy, and it was... I think it's fair to say you had a particularly tough pandemic. You had a relationship that ended, and you lost someone that you were very close to. And your show was sort of, you know, getting into some of that stuff. What do you remember of that time?
Oh, I remember it all. Clear as day. Yeah, I mean, I think everybody had what a politician's answer. Everybody had a tough pandemic.
It reminds me of like the war that grandparents or great grandparents would talk about whether you had a good war or a bad war. And I think it's a bit like that with pandemic, isn't it? If you lost someone close to you and all of that.
Yes, whether it was profitable.
Right. Yeah, you avoid that too, yeah.
Yeah. No, I think it was I mean, there were, good bits and bad bits, I suppose. There's elements that were positive. It wasn't sort of pure misery the whole time. But Yeah, I lost a friend in just at the end of all of it, really, in 2022, in February, just as we were kind of coming out of the other side. And he was somebody that I worked very closely on my shows with. He directed my shows, and he was a very good friend of mine. And I think it's just a big knock, really. I think it was just such a big shift in my life with all of the other things that you mentioned, all of the other changes happening, and just the way that the world shifted with the pandemic. That it was, my life pre-pandemic and my life post-pandemic looked pretty much unrecognizable in terms of my day-to-day, the people that I kind of worked with or saw on a regular basis. So I think that the show I did before this one was just, I had to kind of find some way to process this information and also honour Paul, my friend who passed away. One of the things that I really enjoy about stand-up comedy is the challenge of writing about things that aren't necessarily funny. And grief is a very difficult one. Death is a hard thing to make funny. I think there's amazing examples of people doing stand-up comedy about death, but it's such a delicate line to tread. Maria Bamford, there's a clip of Maria Bamford doing stand-up about her mother passing away, and it's so beautifully done and so carefully pitched. And it's very, very funny. And I think I really admire the craftsmanship of managing to toe that line of, because if you go too far in one direction, people might think that you're being sort of flippant or disrespectful. And if you go too far in the other, they might start feeling sorry for you. And so it is just, I think there's a challenge in trying to communicate, because it's very hard to, I mean, some people are really good. Some people say that they're at their best when they're at their worst on stage. I'm definitely not. I'm at my best when I'm feeling well in my head. So I think when all of this happened, I was going to work feeling quite sad and finding it very difficult to pretend I was anything other than sad. So I kind of had to find a way to compromise with myself and sort of go, okay, well, you've got to go out there and you've got to make them laugh, but there's no reason that you can't be honest about where you're at in your life.
I read one interview where you said, grief turns you into a blob of a human being that just has to continue to exist in this world. I think that's a feeling that would be familiar to anyone who's lost someone important to them. You know, was that really how you managed then, by focusing on creating a show as a kind of tribute, or were there other things?
Yeah, I don't know if I did manage.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so, in a way, yeah. I think there was maybe a sense of relief when I decided that that was what I was going to do, because the thought of carrying on in a sort of, in any way that kind of ignored it was impossible. It felt like the right thing to do to address the grief head on and kind of go, okay, well, how are we, like, if this is where I'm at, especially because the way that the industry works in the UK is that there is an expectation to have a show quite on a regular basis. So I was like, okay, well, I've committed to having a show at the Edinburgh Fringe in August. I'm going to have to go. I'm going to have an hour of things to say. Might as well have the thing that I have to say be the thing that I'm thinking about all of the time right now. And yeah, I think it does just turn you into, you're just sort of going through the motions. You're just sort of slugging about, trying to just get through whatever thing you need to do till you can kind of go home and then just sort of melt all over the floor, I think, when you're grieving. So yeah, I think a big part of my choice to do that show was just there's no other way forward.
Yeah. All right, so let's come to your fourth choice then. So this one is from 2010. Tell us about this game.
Red Deep 10. That's, it's Red Dead, isn't it? Red Dead Redemption.
Thank you.
again, this is, it might not be 2010 because it's Red Dead Redemption 2.
Okie doke. All right, yeah.
Is the one I'm thinking of. So does that mess up our chronological order?
It's fine. We'll just roll with it.
I should have put this in the email. It was a panic email. I haven't, this might be a controversial thing to say on a very popular gaming podcast. I haven't played the original Red Dead. I haven't. I'm so sorry. I will. I should.
Don't think you have to have, do you? Red Dead 2 definitely stands as its own thing, doesn't it?
I'm aware of what happens and who you play as. I am aware. And maybe I should, out of respect, go and play it. But I didn't have... So I was kind of off gaming for a long time because I didn't own a console for a very long time. So I think in the period, I don't know when did I get my PlayStation? I think I got my PlayStation 4 in about 2017. And up until that point, I'd spent, a long time without a console. Partially because I was attempting to be a stand-up comedian and I had no money to spend on consoles. So yeah, there's a period of gaming that definitely passed me by. And then I don't know when Red Dead 2 came out.
Oh gosh, yeah. I don't know, 2018 was it? I'd have to look it up.
Yeah, maybe a bit harder, don't know.
Yeah, 2018, yeah.
So yeah, it's probably around the same time that I got my PlayStation 4 that it came out, and I got it, I think I got it in 2019, because I remember playing a lot of it in 2020. And as a game to play in a national lockdown, it was the best one I could have inadvertently accidentally saved. Because
it's very outdoorsy, isn't it?
It's so outdoorsy. You feel so free. There was something so... The escapism at that particular time in my life. And it's an amazing game. And I love open world games. I love games that give you a real wealth of possibility in that sort of... I thought about putting GTA on this list, but I think that I have... a sort of love-hate relationship with GTA, I think, in that I find it a really addictive game to play, but I don't know. But I love that kind of huge map.
Yeah.
Interact with whatever you want to interact with, go wherever you want to go, and loads to do if you just want to spend several hours pretending to fish, you can. And I just, I just loved it. I love the animation, like the graphics are unbelievable. And yeah, there'd be moments where I think...
Yeah, it's a beautiful game. Yeah.
Somebody'd walk in on me in 2020 and I'm, as far as they're concerned, I'm stood on the top of a mountain staring out, watching the birds fly. But I'm in my tiny little flat in northwest London on the hottest summer we've ever had in our lives.
Yeah, locked indoors.
Not allowed to go for my second walk of the day.
Yeah, I've had lots of people on the podcast who talked about games like this that they played during the pandemic that were, very sort of set in the countryside and, in mountains and things like that. I think it really, video games provided that function of, for people, didn't they, at that time?
I had a friend who, as I say, I didn't really get into, I don't really... engage with the kind of online function of gaming that much. I think I did a little bit of it during the pandemic. I played some FIFA with some friends and things, but I had a friend who said that they would go on Red Dead with their friends and be talking through headphones, and they'd all gather around a fire in the game and they'd all sit around the fire and then talk.
Tell ghost stories.
Yeah, basically, which I think is like one of the maybe like loveliest and also saddest stories out of the pandemic, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Brilliant. So, Sarah, you said right at the top of our conversation that you had top surgery, which is a voluntary mastectomy. I imagine that was a decision that you didn't take lightly. And also, of course, it's the subject of your new show. What were your anxieties around whether or not to take that step?
I mean, it's such a huge, surgery. I'd never had surgery in my life. So I had a double mastectomy in September of last year, which was a gender affirming choice. I never particularly identified with my chest before having this done. In fact, sort of growing up, when my chest developed, I felt very unhappy and dysphoric about it for my entire adult life, really. And most of my adult life has been spent trying to hide my body, hide my chest. And my friend had top surgery the year before me. And it never really factored in to my head that this could ever be something that was possible. I think the relationship and the conversation about gender is changing so much that there's so much nuance to it now, and you don't necessarily have to be somebody who identifies as trans or is who is transitioning in order to feel as though you want or need to have something like this that's just going to make you feel better or more in touch with yourself. And when my friend had it done, I remember feeling so happy and excited for them, and also this kind of blinding jealousy where I was like, that looks amazing, and that's exactly what I would love to do. And it was really that kind of made me realize that it was possible, and that it wouldn't be a huge drastic thing that would get everybody talking and make everyone go, oh my God, what have you done? And that it could actually just be a sort of a personal thing that's done for me. And it is, yeah, it's just for me. Because I keep saying this, I had my top surgery done, what was it, almost 6 months ago. A lot of people haven't noticed. Which, you know, I didn't have a massive chest. So, I mean, I was absolutely, because I paid for my surgery, which I'm very fortunate that I was able to do. But I did hope that he would do it the by size. I thought, surely he'll knock a bit off the cost because of these guys. There was a naive part of me, maybe slightly arrogant part of me, that thought I'd go in for my initial consultation and he'd go, oh, we could have them off now.
Yeah.
But lay
down over there. We'll sort that out.
Yeah. Oh, I can. Yeah, that'll take a couple of minutes. Yeah, I don't know why, but no, same price for everybody, which I suppose is fair.
What for people like me who don't have gender dysphoria, what was it like for you once your scars had healed? Like setting aside the rest of the world and what other people think and all of that, how did it? Just, you know, you said it was something you did for yourself. How did that feel once you were on the other side of it? What change did it make for you?
Well, I think I'm still getting there. So it takes about a year to kind of fully heal from this surgery. So there's still, you know, my scars are still quite prevalent. Like they will fade more than they have now. And I think these sort of moments of what you'd call gender euphoria, I suppose, are coming in sort of waves. In that, like, one of my first moments was just putting on a t-shirt without a sports bra and without having breasts for the first time, and seeing that silhouette and that flat chest that I have wanted or tried to achieve for so many years, and having that moment of going, like, This is me now. This is what I get to have for the rest of my life. It was so incredible. So incredible. And I mean, I think any kind of aesthetic surgery that somebody has, that to change something that has been bothering them for their entire life, you can't underestimate that sense of relief when it's over, when it's done. And you go, I don't have to think about that anymore. I don't have to feel like not embarrassed. I did, yeah, I think, not that anybody would find it embarrassing, but I felt embarrassed of my chest, and I don't have to feel self-conscious, and I don't have to, you know, hunch my shoulders to hide that anymore. I can stand with my shoulders back and my chest out and not feel like it looks feminine or womanly or anything like that. And it's just a really comfortable feeling, just a really, like, exciting moment of going, the possibilities for me now are, yeah, it's amazing.
You talk about these kind of things with, like, a real light touch, I think, and you do that in your stage show as well, you know, at a time when many people do not, like, you know, or it can be a very sort of heated discussions and all of that. How do you maintain such a sort of calm approach to dialogue when, you know, I suppose the world can often be quite hostile towards people who are going through what you're going through.
I think it's really difficult to, and I don't always, I think I make an effort to kind of try and be as calm and as good humoured as possible, because I think that is the best way to reach people. All I want to do with this show, My Eyes Are Up Here, my new show, is to make people laugh. And that's what happened. And I've written a lot of material about my surgery and this experience and choosing to have this done and the process of what I have to go through. And it makes people laugh. And what I've done it, and it's, and I've seen sort of grown middle-aged men with their wives or their children, you know, people that maybe sort of in a sort of stereotypical way I would clock in an audience and think, oh God, I'm not quite sure what he's going to make of my stuff or what he's going to think of this. And that's probably an unfair assessment of him in himself. But, and they're laughing because, and I'm taking this show on tour around the UK, and I want it to be an experience where people watch the show on a Friday night in Northampton, wherever I'm going, and go, that was really funny and really enjoyable. And maybe at some point I learned something, or I felt like I connected with somebody from that walk of life or that experience, but I didn't feel as though I'd come into a lecture or a rally, or I felt like I was having my, or somebody's political views forced upon me. And I think that is actually the most powerful way of, you know, somebody might read something about top surgery or might read something about trans people or non-binary people and think of me and go, oh, well, that was like that show of Sarah's that we saw and they were talking about that. And then it's a sort of minute shift. It's a minute change, but it could be quite an effective one in the long run if you know, this somebody like that hears somebody else talking about someone like me and says, oh no, we saw a comedian talking about that and it was really funny and it was quite relatable and it wasn't militant or aggressive or anything like that. It was just, you know, we just had a good time. Then I think that's worthwhile. I think that's the best way to meet people in the middle.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's always how these changes in culture come about. And that's how it happened for gay people 30 years ago, for women in positions of leadership, you know, in the 50s before that, and even before that, you know, ending slave trade and things like that. It's always just sort of hearing people's human stories and connected to that, and then change follows.
Yeah, and characters in comedy shows, representation. I don't think anybody's opinion about a thing is going to be changed by, you know, shouting and screaming and arguing and or in person or online or in comments and things like that. But if they watch a TV show and they find a character really funny, they might warm to the idea of them being gay or trans or non-binary, or, you know, I think it's a lot more powerful to appeal to the kind of thing that we have in common.
All right, Sarah, let's come to your fifth and your final game then. Tell us about this one.
It's The Last of Us 1 and 2. We go directly from a serious conversation about gender and identity and acceptance to a zombie apocalypse. Though to be fair, big themes of the nature of human beings.
That's true.
In both The Last of Us 1 and 2. What makes us human? What makes us monsters? Who are the real... What's the real evil in this game? Is the big question. I played the first Last of Us right after I got it. I think it was... I was given it right after I got my PlayStation 4. So it was one of the first games I played. And what... I mean, I love a good narrative. I love an engaging story. But what I also... I love games where you're not given everything that you need. You kind of have to be tactical about what you're using and the resources you have. And this game, I think, does it really well in that you might have three bullets and one stick and you have to get across somewhere and you have to... I like stealth games and having to logic something out, and the amount of times that I died in that game just over and over again. And then you go, okay, I need to think of a different way of approaching this level because I can't do it the way I'm doing it. I just thought it was so good. Just really enjoyed it. Played it through a couple of times. And then The Last of Us 2 came out, I think that was 2020.
Yeah, this was another pandemic game, wasn't it, that everyone played here?
Pandemic game. Oh, God. The shock of my life. Well, that first, I remember there's a comedian, you might have had him, Glenn Moore.
Yeah, he's been on, yeah.
Big into, yeah, games. Texting him, I think that we both started playing it on the same day. And just, I don't know what's going on. How can we go on? And I don't want to give any spoilers, because obviously some people might listen to this who haven't played it. And also, I'm very aware that these are spoilers for a TV show now as well. So.
Right, yeah. Yeah, it's going to be interesting how they deal with that, I think, in the TV show, isn't it?
I'm so hesitant to say anything. I don't know whether we just like do a big spoiler warning and say that if you are listening to this and you don't want to hear about what happened in The Last of Us 2, then skip or something. Because I don't know how do we discuss this without discussing it.
I'll leave it up to you, Sarah.
Well, I don't know what they're going to do. I don't know how they're going to... I think it's going to be a global heartbreak. And the genius of that game, which I'm excited to see how... Because I think it'd be hard... It's easier to do it in a game because you force people to play as a character. And I'm very intrigued as to how they'll play it in a more passive setting where you're just watching. But forcing you to play as Abby for a huge portion of the game and then seeing her point of view and seeing her story and her perspective is so clever and so horrible in that you're like, I don't want to feel this. I don't want to empathize with you. I want to be angry at you.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, it's very clever because then I think we can say that the game leads to this sort of ultimate face-off fight in the dirt between two of the protagonists who both have good reasons to hate each other, but whom, as you say, like as a player, you know both of their stories and so you empathise with both of them. And so it puts you as a player in quite an interesting position, doesn't it? Because you're not typically in films, you'd side with one person over the other, but you can't do that easily in this.
It's very hard to know who to root for.
Right.
And that is, I guess, the whole time is the point of this series and this game, is that all of these human beings have their own stories and they're all being forced into situations in which they have to fight for their survival and do things they wouldn't necessarily do in other circumstances. And makes you think.
Yeah, it does, yeah.
Makes you think.
Yeah, there's a quote from a New Yorker writer, I can't remember who it is now, but I think they were giving one of these addresses at a university and they said it's impossible to hate someone when you know their story, which I'm not sure if it's 100% true, but it's certainly a long way true, I think.
Yeah, it definitely is true in this context.
Yeah.
I started trying to play The Last of Us 2 again recently and I got to... that early cutscene. And I thought, you know what, I don't need to do this.
I just walk away.
I don't need to go back there.
I'm going to make you narrow it down. So which one would you pick out of the two for your console?
Oh, okay. Oh, I think the first one.
Okay.
I think the first one.
I think it's got a pretty even split for guests on the podcast. So it's been picked a few times, both the first and the second one. I think Glenn picked part two. So yeah.
Did he?
Yeah.
It is incredible. It's just that I can't. I'm too fragile.
All right. So let's go through your console then. So we've got Worms, The Sims, Little Big Planet 3, Red Dead Redemption 2, and The Last of Us Part 1. Very good console.
Yeah.
We need a name for your console to market it to the world. Can you come up with something we can call it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know why my instinctive brain, because you asked me what I call my worms, and I was like, I just call it Jack.
Is that your cousin or your brother? Your cousin, right?
Yeah, I just call it my cousin's name. Jack the console. Cousin Jack the console. Cousin, I feel like Cousin Jack could be a good gaming brand name.
Yeah, right, yeah. Sounds like a lovely bar, actually, as well.
It does, yeah.
Let's go to Cousin Jack's.
Is the horrible something Jack's? Is the sours?
Oh, yeah, okay, right.
Apple sours, yeah. Something Jack.
Sarah, it's been so lovely to get to know you, and thanks for being so open and honest with our chat, and all the best with the tour as well, yeah.
Thank you very much. Nice to meet you.
Thank you so much to my guest, Sarah Keyworth. What a wonderful person Sarah is. I thoroughly loved hearing Sarah's thoughts on these games and their life, and you know, just so grateful to Sarah for being vulnerable and open and talking about quite personal things. I mean, I know Sarah's got a tour all about this stuff, so it's, you know, not averse to talking about this stuff in the public eye. But even so, you know, this is a podcast about video games, and, you know, perhaps not quite expected that we would go to some of those places, but that's how we roll around these parts. I just loved, as I said in the interview, I think Sarah just has such a light touch, talking about some of these issues that are like right at the center of culture war-y nonsense. And it's just really helpful, I think, to hear a human being speaking about their lived experience and perspective. So I hope you appreciated that. And of course, wonderful to have the image of Sarah playing Worms with her cousins and naming each of her worms after her cousins so that they had to destroy themselves in the game. Absolutely love that, as well as, you know, the rather traumatic image of Sarah's character in The Sims inviting all of their various girlfriends to a party at the same time and watching the chaos and mayhem ensue. Very cool. Brilliant. So Sarah is on tour the week that this comes out, actually the weekend after this comes out. Sarah is performing at the Comedy Store in Sydney, so I know we do have some listeners in Australia. Hi. If you're in Sydney, get along, see Sarah's show there. Then Sarah's performing for most of the month of August at Edinburgh at the Monkey Barrel, so the 1st to the 25th of August. And then the tour starts around the UK proper in early September. So kicking off on the 11th of September at Norwich, then Leicester, Reading, London, Exeter, Bath, Brighton, Northampton, Coventry, Lancaster, Manchester, Portsmouth, Winchester, and well, on and on and on. I won't keep reading those out because it's a very extensive tour all the way through to December. You can find out all about those dates and buy tickets for the shows that aren't already sold out, because some of them are, because Sarah's a very popular comic, at sarahkeyworth.co.uk. And there you can follow the links through to whichever show is near where you live. Please do that. Go and support Sarah. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Always wonderful to have you. Thank you. If this is your first episode you're listening to because you're a Sarah Keyworth fan, welcome. You're very welcome here. We do have lots of other episodes with some of Sarah's friends. Glenn Moore, very good friend of the podcast. You can go back and listen to his episode. Pierre Novelli. And lots of other people from that little gang of UK comics, as well as, of course, people from the video game industry and other industries as well. We've got a run, actually, of novelists coming up. I'm slightly biased towards writers, as you may have noticed from some of the lineup. I do have lots more writers than, for example, athletes. Apologies for that, but I mean that's partly a function of the fact that I'm friends with lots of writers, and that's the world I live in. But anyway, yeah, we've got a few exciting writers coming up in coming weeks and talking about their books, so excited to share those with you. Next week, though, we have a games industry legend. Oh my gosh, I'm so excited to share this episode with you. My guest is Masaya Matsuura, creator of Parappa the Rapper. Yes, I know. How cool is that? And of course, some Jamalami, Mojib Ribbon, Vib Ribbon, all those other games on PlayStation and PlayStation 2 and some other things that came out later. There's a Wii game, wasn't there? Major Miners, Majestic March. And Masaya has not... He is a musician, first and foremost. That's how he started out, as a pop musician in Tokyo with his band Size. And then started making video games in the early 90s, originally for the Apple Bandai Pippin, that short-lived console. And that then morphed into the creation of Parappa the Rapper, which I'm sure you know about, but that is essentially the game that invented the rhythm action genre that led to Guitar Hero, to Rock Band, to all of those music games that really transformed the landscape of video games for a good few years there. We've got Masaya to thank for that. I had a long chat with him. Heads up, his game choices, we kind of have to use inverted commas for games. Only one of them, I think, is strictly speaking a video game. The other are all sort of pieces of software or instruments and other things that he... So he's used a very broad definition of video games, but it's a good chat. And Masaya is just a lovely person who I've had the privilege to get to know over the last decade or so. And it's a good time. So I'm going to be sharing that with you next week. In the meantime, if you would like to write to me, you can do so at myperfectconsole@gmail.com. Thank you to those of you who do. I'm going to be doing a correspondence episode in May. So if you've got any thoughts, any suggestions, any questions, please do write to me, myperfectconsole@gmail.com. It doesn't have to be a long email. Just send it in and, you know, it's all good. I can read it out and get into anything that you were asking about. Be lovely to hear from you. You can also send ideas for guests. Many, many of you do that, and I do have a very long list. And some of the people you suggest I've already recorded with and are coming up in future months, and other people I'm like, oh yeah, I should definitely ask that person. And so it's all very helpful. If you want to get more involved in the podcast, head to patreon.com/myperfectconsole. You can become a supporter. You get your episodes early and ad-free. You get to be part of the community there. You get a bonus episode every month with this month's one and previous one is with Glenn Moore. That's we've been playing through Stephen's Sausage Roll through this month. That was a choice. One of the game picks by the neuroscientist Patrick House. We've been playing through that collectively, the listeners of My Perfect Console, and I'm going to be discussing that on a bonus episode with Glenn Moore. I think that comes out this week, actually. So, yeah, hurry up and become a Patreon supporter and you can listen to that. It'll be a good time. You can follow the podcast on Twitter at My Perfect Console with the O's removed. Also on Instagram, things like that. I'm not great at social media. It's just, oh my gosh, so much to do, and I have a job as well as My Perfect Console, even though I absolutely love doing this, but it is becoming a bit of a monster and taking up lots of time, which I love and adore, and it's brilliant that it's popular and people are enjoying it. So yeah, but it, you know, not 100% over the socials all the time is my point. I do try to post clips and things like that, a couple of times a week, and an update on guest choices of games if you're interested in finding out more about that. We do have like a website for the podcast, which is imminent, I think, which will have some of that information as well, which has very kindly been created by some of the listeners as well. So thank you to them. I'll announce more of that when it's up and running and point you in that direction. quite enough from me babbling on. Thank you again, Sarah. Go book some tickets to Sarah's tour. And I'll be back again next week with Masaya Matsura. Yes. And his 5 inverted commas games and one more perfect console.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.